Hi, podcast listener. Fraser here. So this is an episode where it's going to be an interview with me, not by me. And this is an interview that I did on the Pale Blue Pod podcast. And for those of you who aren't familiar, Pale Blue Pod is amazing. It is co-hosted by my friend, Dr. Moya McTeer. It often sort of battles for first place with Universe Today on the astronomy-related podcasts on Apple Podcasts. And so we figured, why not just combine our forces? And now, of course, I interviewed Dr. McTeer a couple of months ago when we did a ranking of all of the Fermi Paradox solutions. So her voice might sound familiar to you. But in this, they are analyzing the state of academic publishing. And Moya wanted to get my perspective as an outsider of academic publishing, how we choose and interact with stories that we want to research and write for Universe Today. So now I highly recommend that you subscribe to the Pale Blue Pod podcast. It's terrific. There's a reason it sticks up at the very top of the astronomy podcasts. They're so good. So enjoy this interview with me, hosted by Pale Blue Pod.
Welcome to Pale Blue Pod, the astronomy podcast for people who are overwhelmed by the universe but want to be its friend.
Yay! Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Moya McTeer. I'm an astrophysicist, a folklorist, and a friend to the universe.
It's true. And I'm Cree Fido. I'm a writer and a friend to the universe.
Friend, where are we recording this episode today?
We are in a spot we've been before, a beloved spot, the Multitude office.
Yeah, we're returning back to our home base because Multitude is the collective that we are a part of here at Pale Blue Pod. And we didn't want to have to move too many times for this episode because we have a special guest. I'm actually heading out in a little bit to interview an independent publisher. That's a hint. Today we're talking about publishing. I'll be stepping out soon to talk to an independent publisher, and then Corinne and I will get back together in the studio to chat about what I learned. But today we're talking about all types of academic publishing, both traditional and serious and formal and independent and fun. Can you tell how I feel about independent media as a host of an independent podcast?
It's hard.
Yeah. Corinne, what are your first thoughts on academic publishing? Is this something you've been curious about?
Yeah. So when I was in college, I was a temp at a research hospital, and everyone around me was like the scientists who were collecting the data to publish their own papers. And they were always making their posters and going to conferences and trying to publish things. So I'm a little bit familiar with the grind of it, but it was fun to be a part of the office and have no stakes at all. But really all I know is that there could be many names on a paper.
Yes. I think we've talked about et al. Before. Mm-hmm. When you're citing a paper, you use the author's last name.
Yeah.
So for me, I would say McTeer 2024 or something. If there are two authors, you say both. You could say McTeer and Caputo 2024. But if there are more than three authors, you just say McTeer et al.
Mm-hmm.
And some papers have up to, especially more recently on these huge international collaborations, for the Event Horizon Telescope, or something with the JWST, hundreds.
Yeah.
Hundreds of authors. Yeah.
That's so many.
Which I think is beautiful because everyone who contributes, should get credit.
I like everyone getting credit. That is important to me.
All right. So you know that there can be many authors. Are there things that you're curious about that you want to know by the end of this episode?
I think I have no idea what the process is. You do your research, you I assume write it on your computer, but I don't know what happens after that. Or kind of what the goal is or what where you want it to end up either.
Oh, that's a very interesting point. If I don't address that, be sure to bring it up at the end because that's changed over time.
Ooh, okay.
That last bit about what is publishing even for?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let me give kind of the bounds of what we're going to talk about today because publishing is huge, and we're not talking about music publishing, obviously. We're not talking about commercial publishers doing popular science books. We are not even talking about news publications like the New York Times or whatever. And we're not talking about individuals self-publishing, like how scientists used to do hundreds of years ago with their treatises, how Galileo wrote all of those articles, just putting them out himself.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about academic publishing, which means nowadays research information, like new knowledge that comes from specific academic organizations, and those organizations decide what they publish. And usually, almost always these days, they are peer reviewed. Like any reputable journal is going to be peer reviewed.
That I've heard of.
Okay. Yeah. What does that mean to you, peer review?
What I think it means is that there's like person who kind of gets the data that you're citing or gets the paper in advance and then doesn't, I think it's like blind, right? Like you don't know who the author of the paper is when you're peer reviewing something.
It does depend on the journal. They have different policies.
Oh, okay. And then I think you like confirm if the conclusion's correct.
Very interesting.
Is that not what it is? Because I feel like that's what it should be.
Kind of, but what you described is actually way better, better than it actually is. I'll talk about it a little bit later, but the peer reviewer, they do not get your data.
Oh.
They just get the paper.
Huh.
And sometimes they see the author's name. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes the author gets to submit a list of people they don't want to review their paper in case there's a conflict of interest.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a lot more kind of like shoddy as a process than a lot of people give it credit for. And it's kind of like the process gets out of it whatever the reviewers, the individual reviewers, are willing to put into it.
Yeah. You know, they talk about this on High Maintenance sometimes where they'll like reference a study and like maybe talk about how it shouldn't have been cited as often as it is in like other pieces. But I'm certainly assuming the best in the process and maybe I shouldn't.
I mean, we do have to trust process while also admitting that the process isn't perfect.
Yeah.
But this is the best process we have come up with so far. And there are people trying to improve it and come up with new systems that would be better as we speak. I'll get into it a bit. But I want to start with the history of publishing before we look to the future of it. And I do want to say that, of course, people were publishing things all the way back into antiquity, you know, like the ancient scholars in the Islamic world, people in ancient China, like they were writing down manuscripts when they were doing their studies. But that doesn't necessarily fall under the definition of academic publishing that I gave. So that we can trace back as we can trace back many processes in science. We can trace it back to Europe in the 1600s, kind of after the scientific method was formalized and people were doing like rigorous experiments and control groups and things like that, or at least they were trying to. Around that time, the first formalized academic societies started to appear. Galileo was in one of the very first in Rome, the Lincian Society, or like I think it's called also the Lynx Society. And those academic groups, they started journals to publish their members' findings. And you asked about this. Originally, they were just publishing it for other members of the society. They didn't expect anyone outside their society to be interested or able to read them, and they honestly didn't care, probably, because the movement to actually educate the public about the scientific research that gets done, that's fairly new, you know, in the last, like, 50 years.
Okay.
So that's going back to the 1600s. Around 1945, like, it was
quite
like
a jump
for 300 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for 300 years, it's these academic societies publishing their findings. Around 1945, people realized that the skill sets for researchers and publishers were different from each other. They were distinct enough that the roles started to separate. You didn't want to have a bunch of researchers also running a publication. And that divide got bigger until the 1970s, when professional publishers kind of en masse took over the responsibility of printing, distributing, and marketing these journals for different academic institutions. And the marketing is important because it's around this time the movement for public education has started, and a lot of this research is taxpayer funded. And so it behooves these institutions to make their research at least a little bit more accessible to the public. So maybe they will advertise it to more universities or something.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. This whole process of printing, distributing, and marketing, also like completely separating the publisher from the researcher and creating the publisher middleman, mm-hmm. that introduced new fees. And someone had to pay sure. these fees instead of just members to a society paying their membership dues and then getting access to the journal. In the 1990s, the major publishers started putting a lot of their journals online, and this reduced their costs because they didn't have to print as much, they didn't have to mail as much, but they started adding fees anyway. They started adding digital subscription fees to pay for, I guess, you know, like editing labor. Obviously, the patrons have access to the research notes for this episode, and in that, there was an article about what these publishers actually do and what they spend the money on.
Yeah.
And one of the line items was paying peer reviewers. But spoiler alert, and I'll say this again later, peer reviewers do not get paid. So they increase fees while reducing their costs.
Yeah.
It's a little shady.
Classic move. Classic mm-hmm. move.
Classic move. This caused a huge problem in the aughts among library networks, and it was known as the serials crisis. Libraries couldn't keep up with the journal subscription fees, and they started having to drop these journals and couldn't provide access to people in the public who needed to know what was in these journals. And it's not just public libraries. It was also libraries at universities or like research labs, but especially public libraries. Mm-hmm. And that serials crisis, as it was called, kind of led to the open access movement, which is this big push for making research free and publicly accessible.
Cool.
And people, like, publishers are trying to do that, but they're still stuck in like a capitalist framework.
Yeah.
So the money has to come from somewhere. So they're kind of just shuffling it around because they don't want to affect their bottom lines, because
sure.
these publishers are for-profit companies.
Right.
So their incentive is to keep making more money and not necessarily to actually spread scientific knowledge.
Right.
Yes. So that's the history of publishing. That's what got us to where we are now. And it's still shady. There's still money moving in places that I don't really like, but you did want to know how the publishing process works, kind
yeah.
of like from the scientist's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So you do your research, you write your article, you make sure all of the different authors of the article agree on what it says, but there is a primary author. There's a first author who is in charge of submitting the article to the publication and all of the communication back and forth. I'm pretty sure you can only submit an article to one journal at a time.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's true of, like, literally basing this entirely off of, like, humor pieces to submit to the New Yorker or, like, McSweeney's, but it's kind of the same deal. Like,
yeah.
Don't share this.
Right, because if it does get accepted to multiple places,
yeah, you're not,
then
like, rescinding it from one other place. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and these journals don't accept everything that comes their way. There are rejection rates, and the really prestigious journals, they have rejection rates of 90% or more sometimes. So you submit your agreed-upon article to the journal, and each journal usually has its own ridiculously unique formatting specifications. So you format your paper according to whatever they say you have to, you know, like making sure the margins are specific, whatever, making sure your references are in a certain order and format. It's really frustrating, but at least in astronomy, a lot of us are writing our papers in this software called LaTeX, which is kind of like you use coding to do the type of formatting that you wish you could do in Microsoft Word.
Sure, like for your footnotes and for your other things?
For footnotes, for figures, for having columns, for your references, for including equations with special symbols.
I love that.
Yeah, it's incredible. And a lot of the journals will have LaTeX templates that you can download, and then it'll be in their ridiculously specific formatting requirements. So you submit it to the journal, and you usually wait a long time. I'd say on the order of months mm-hmm. to either get rejected or get reviewer comments. In the meantime, what the journal is supposed to be doing is assigning your article to an editor who then goes out and finds people to peer review it from the community, and like who would be familiar with the subfield like with the area. And so the journal finds the peer reviewers. They send them the paper, and they are supposed to have a certain amount of time, like a month or so, to go through it and make comments. There's a classic complaint, like a tropey complaint in at least astronomy academia, and I think it's wider than that, of the comments from reviewer number two. And it's like the joke is that, like, reviewer number one thought that this was great work that showed awesome promise and, sure, you know, whatever. And reviewer number two is like, this shouldn't be accepted because they didn't cite my 1972 paper.
Yes.
Like, reviewer number two always sucks.
That's so funny.
And there usually are multiple reviewers. Like, you wouldn't want to just get one.
Yeah. This is like when I've submitted screenplays to like various festivals or stuff, and you'll get like reader notes back like, ooh, later. And like, they're always contradictory too. It's like one person is like, this is the best dialogue I've ever read. And the next person's like, this, you really struggle with dialogue.
Yes.
Like, all right.
Nothing shows you how subjective the entire human experience is.
It drives me nuts.
Like, getting review feedback.
And it shouldn't drive me so crazy, but I'm like, oh my God, why don't people think exactly the way I think?
Why don't people see this genius that I'm oozing from my brain?
This is one of the best things you could have ever read.
So you either get rejected or you get reviewer comments. You then have time to edit, like respond to their comments and resubmit, and you can repeat that until the paper is accepted or rejected. In my first time ever trying to publish an academic paper, it took a long time to actually get it published because the editor of the journal didn't think it was worth publishing.
Whoa.
So we had to go back and forth basically trying to convince them that it wasn't even a null result. It was my exotopography paper, which I've talked about before on the pod. And it was just us saying, we don't have the ability to do this now, but we will in like 20 years. And here's how we would find mountains.
Here's how we'll do it. Yeah.
Yeah. And they didn't want to publish it just because it wasn't relevant now. And I was like, no, it's still relevant.
Yeah.
We can't do it, but like, we could still do simulations. We could still improve on this work. Like, what do you mean? Well, so they did eventually publish it, but it was at least 6 months after I submitted. And that's kind of a quick go around.
I was going to say that's quick. That feels long to me.
I know. It should be faster. I liked to wait until after the paper was officially accepted by the journal, but other people will do this next step earlier. You post your paper on the archive, which is this publicly available and free repository of papers that people write in. Not just astronomy, like there's one for bio, there's one for medical stuff, blah, blah, blah. And you post there because the open access movement has made people realize that everyone should be able to read these papers, not just the very wealthy people who can afford the fees.
Sure.
And I have a section later where I kind of like walk through the money of it all and how much things cost. So you post on archive, and that way you have a link that you can share on social media, and if your goal is to get people reading your research, and today a lot of researchers would say that is their goal, studies have shown that if you post about your paper on social media, you get more citations because people know about it.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, because there's such a huge flood of papers being published each day, it's hard to actually go through it. And if you see something on social media, it just will bring it to the top of your mind.
Yeah, sure.
In the whole publishing process, there are three major players. There are the scholars who generate knowledge and then the actual content that goes into publishing, usually in the form of articles, but also books, especially in some fields like history, I've learned. Books are more common than like individual papers.
Oh, yeah. Huh. That kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So there are the authors, and then there are the publishers, and they manage and curate and distribute and market the journals. It sounds like they do a lot, but they have also kind of constructed all of this labor for themselves.
Sure.
They edit the articles and they assign peer reviewers. So there's the writers, there's the publishers, and then there are are the consumers, the readers. These are universities, libraries, maybe laboratories and other research institutions. These are the people who pay the publisher's subscription fees so that their people, their students, their employees or whatever can access the information, which they then use to write more papers. So the readers become the writers, and it's this whole cycle that has to, like, if it stops moving, the system collapses.
Sure, yeah. As with many systems here.
Yeah, yeah. And we've known since the cereals crisis, at least since the cereals crisis in the aughts, that this system isn't sustainable because the publishers keep inflating their fees. So I wanted to get a sense for how much money is actually involved in publishing. And one common misconception is that people think the authors of scientific articles get paid to write their articles.
Yeah, I think I only know they don't because of you. Because we've talked about it in various ways over the episodes.
Yes. So, no, we don't get paid. In fact, we have to pay. We have to pay something called an article processing charge, or an APC, to publish in most journals. Now, there are some journals that are free to publish in, but most of the major ones make you pay. And these fees typically range from a few hundred dollars to $2,000. Like,
oh,
over $1,000. Yeah. Ridiculous.
So what do? You have to raise the money or use your grant or use your stipend? I don't know.
Great, great question. For students at universities and for people with advisors, like I think a lot of postdocs probably, this money almost always comes from their advisor's funding, from their advisor's grant or whatever. Like that is written into grant proposals. Although I think my advisor just told me to submit to a journal that didn't take fees.
Didn't charge. Makes sense.
Yeah. So scholars pay to have their stuff published. The peer reviewers who are doing the work that supposedly underpins this entire system, they do not get paid. Nothing. And so the people who we expect to rigorously check all of this work, they're not actually incentivized to carefully check all of this work. They're incentivized to get through it as quickly as possible because reviewing these articles is seen as a compulsory act of service in academia. It's like jury duty for scientists.
Yeah, that sucks.
Mm-hmm. So they do not get paid. And then the universities and libraries will pay thousands of dollars per year for a single journal just to have access to their articles. I did find an article that gave like the range of prices, and it ranged from like $2,000 per year for one journal to $8,000 per year for one journal.
For one.
Ridiculous. And some journals are trying to follow the open access trend by doing away with subscription fees so that everyone can read their stuff. But they're putting that responsibility on authors by increasing the article processing charge.
Oh, geez.
Because, like I said before, they're for-profit organizations.
Right.
I found this statistic from the consulting firm Outsell. The typical profit margins for these publishers of academic journals is 20 to 30%.
That feels high.
Yeah.
I don't know how businesses work, but I tend to get very shocked when I learn that, how razor-thin margins are for so many companies.
Mm-hmm. This is higher than it should be for a company whose mission should be just to share knowledge with the world.
Yeah.
And like, sure, whatever. Someone can hear this and come in and call me naive and say like, well, this is how the world works, Missy. But like, this is just the world we built. This is not how the world has to work.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Although not all of the major journals are published by these like huge third-party publishing companies. The American Astronomical Society publishes a bunch of its own journals. Two of them are kind of like the top subscribed or the most subscribed to astronomy journals. They are the Astrophysical Journal, or APJ, and the Astronomical Journal, or AJ. And I hate that they are separate things. That's my hot take.
I do.
And I know it comes from this history where astrophysicists and astronomers were beefing and they were like, we are different. And they both thought that they were better than the other. Like, I know it has a history there, but Just combine them. Just combine them. Except both of those are operated by AAAS. They cannot just combine them into one because there is already a journal called Astronomy and Astrophysics.
Oh my gosh, okay.
Yeah, so that one is an international journal that's published by EDP Sciences, a big publisher that when I Googled it, I kind of got the impression that if I dug too deep, I would find really unsavory things.
Yeah, interesting.
But also, listeners, I'm just a girl. I don't know business. I'm just an astrophysicist. I don't know.
Sure. Who's good in the end?
Yeah. And then this is the journal that I always submitted my work to, the Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. It is published by the Royal Astronomical Society and also Oxford University Press and also another company that I didn't want to look too into called Wiley Blackwell. So all three of them together publish MNRAS, as the cool kids
say. MNRAS, mm-hmm. How fun.
And then kind of like the big ones that people want to publish in because they have more readership in just like the general public are Science, the journal Science, which is published by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, mm-hmm. and Nature, which has a bunch of journals under it, including Nature Astronomy. This is published by the Nature Portfolio, which is also like a big publishing company. And people rush to publish there. It's a super prestigious journal. But I do remember hearing news when I was in grad school that because people rush to publish in Nature, it also has the most retractions of the journals. But I couldn't find that statistic.
Yeah.
So take it with a grain of salt. But speaking of statistics, how many scientific academic papers do you think are published every year, Corinne?
Oh my gosh, I have no idea. I think it's in the thousands.
Okay. 3 million scientific peer-reviewed articles are published every year.
3 million. That is so many.
3 million. It's growing. It's been increasing steadily since 1970. And when people look at the specifics of these papers, they can see that the papers are getting more specialized, like getting into more and more niche topics, and sure. also less impactful mm-hmm. over time. By impactful, I mean people pay attention to the paper for less time. Found this one paper that studied what they called the half-life of different articles. And they were like, back in 1960, when someone published a paper, people would be talking about that paper for 50 years because they were like the seminal things in the field, like establishing all the basics. By the time you get to 2010 or something, people have kind of forgotten that paper in a couple years.
Yeah.
If that paper was ever cited, more than half of the papers that are published get maybe one citation.
Yeah, there's just too many. There's too much content.
Exactly. It's a problem. There are currently more than 25,000 submissions on the astronomy paper database called the Astrophysics Data System every day.
It is so many.
It's too many. It's too many. Most astronomy papers have 3 to 20 authors. I don't know why. I got this from an article. I don't know why they binned the numbers that way. They had a color for like one author, a color for two authors, a color for three authors, and then a color for 4 to 20 authors.
That is crazy. That is
20
too many.
To 100, and then 100 plus. 4 to 20 is a weird range, in my opinion.
I guess there's just, like, that's where it drops off significantly. Like, the sample size is just too small.
Yeah,
or
I guess so. But more than half of papers have between 3 and 20 authors, and less than 20% in modern times are single author papers, although those have really, like, swapped. Mm-hmm. It used to be much more single author papers and very few large collaborations, just because internet and other communications technology have made it easier to have larger collaborations.
I like that.
Yeah. We cannot talk about publishing, academic publishing, without talking about publish or perish culture. Is this a phrase you've heard before, publish or perish?
Yes, I have. And I don't, it's not a phrase I've used, but it is kind of a feeling I have as a creative person.
Oh, yeah. As a creator, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think it's always about, like, who cares about the thing you just finished or just accomplished? Like, what's next?
Mm-hmm. Would it surprise you to learn that it's very similar in academia?
Not at all. And we need to move away from this, people.
Yes, I agree. I agree. There's this culture of academic papers being your, like, social currency as a researcher. Your value is dependent on how many papers you've published, but not, it's not even that simple. There are all sorts of metrics that people have come up with to quantify how good you are based on your publication record. The one I'm most familiar with is something called the H index. This is the lowest number that describes the number of papers and citations you have. So, like, in order to have an H index of 5, you have to have at least 5 papers that each have 5 citations.
Okay.
And so on. And people, like, in decisions about academic hiring, people are genuinely bringing up these H indexes and these other metrics to decide if someone should be hired at a university. This is based on outdated ideas that the more visibly productive you are, the better you will be as a researcher and mentor and teacher and colleague, which is just ridiculous, because this entire culture of publisher parish just leads to bad research because people are rushing, definitely bad writing because people aren't incentivized to learn the craft of writing a good paper. They just churn them out as fast as they can. A lot of retractions because people aren't careful. People trying to scoop others, like that really disgusting competitive practice of, like, stealing someone else's work, or if you hear that someone is about to publish something, you just, like, swoop in right before they can. It's disgusting. There's unnecessary competition. There are people who miss cool research because there's just so much coming down the pipeline because we're over-publishing.
Yeah.
It's a bad culture.
Yeah.
And open access might be able to help the, like, public accessibility bit, but unless we change this part of academia, the whole ivory tower is going to be gross and rotted.
Yeah. I see that happening.
Yeah. So that is sad. But looking to the future, people are trying to find ways to change the culture of publishing. There are more creative ways that people are thinking of sharing their research, like definitely through social media videos, but also, you know, there are some, like, online journals that are trying to just publish, like, videos of scholars explaining their research to you in, like, 5 minutes or less, which
love.
Is brilliant.
Yeah, love that.
Yeah, and, like, why shouldn't I be able to cite that?
Yes.
You know, like, why should that be less formal or respected than a paper that no one's going to read?
Yeah, way more appealing and exciting.
So I feel optimistic about the future of academic publishing. And in the meantime, there are cool people who are sharing knowledge with the public without the whole academic publishing apparatus. So I arranged a chat with one of the biggest names in independent astronomy news publishing. He works away from all those big corporate publishers with their shady practices and their high fees. He makes his stuff available for free, and there aren't even really ads. So I'm about to go sit down with Fraser Kane, who is a science journalist, a web developer, and the publisher of Universe Today. It's my favorite site for reading about space news. And Fraser was one of the first people to give me opportunities to report on space news as a young science communicator. So I'm going to go out and speak with him. And then Corinne, I'll come back and we'll chat a little bit more about what we talked about. Great.
Have fun.
Fraser, it's so good to see you. Thanks for inviting me here. Can you tell the listeners where we are?
So I live on Vancouver Island in Canada, and for much of the year, it is this sort of torrential raining rainforest. It's cold, clammy, but around May, June, the weather turns and everything warms up and gets really nice. It's paradise. And so there's a river that flows through my city, And at the side of the river is a park. And in that park, there is a tree that is like a seat that hangs over the river. And I go for a walk, and sometimes I'll take a notebook with me, and I'll sit down on this tree sitting beside the river as people are inner tubing past and sort of do some thoughts. And like the it feels like someone just like carved a tree to be, it's got moss along the top of it so you can sit on it. It's like a, it's like a saddle of a horse. It's perfect. And you just sit on it, and it's just, it's beautiful and kind of a little isolated from the rest of the park. You can sit and think in the middle of nature, and that is like one of my favorite places to go.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Yeah, this is a stunning sight. And you're right, we are pretty isolated. There aren't many people walking by, so I feel like we can record the episode here, no problem. But we still have the river sounds. Are there usually like ducks or geese? Do you see those this far north?
We definitely do. But specifically, there's a bird called a merganser, which is a, it looks like a, like a duck crossed with a wood axe. So its head is like a, is like an axe, has this sort of weird, anyway. And the mergansers will hang out at the rapids of the river, and they will chase little bugs and bits of debris that are floating down the river. And they go up and down these rapids quite well. It's kind of amazing. So,
love that.
Yeah, yeah. And then in the, you know, in the winter time or in the fall, it turns into salmon that are going upstream, and then they all die, and then the, you know, their corpses litter the sides of the river, and it's mayhem. But
it's casual. Yeah. Just casual mayhem on the side of the riverbanks. Awesome. It's extra appropriate that you brought me here today because you said this is where you jot down your ideas for stories in your journal. And I said in your intro that you're the publisher of Universe Today. Can you tell the listeners a bit about what you do at Universe Today, what you cover?
Well, I mean, what I do has changed over time. Like, I started Universe Today 25 years ago. And when it started...
The internet's changed a lot since then.
Yeah, yeah. It was just me. And so I was... essentially just summarizing, reporting on interesting space stories that I was finding around the internet, just as a way to learn more about space, because I've always been interested in space, but just didn't have, you know, I was working in a different field, and so I just wanted a way to sort of express these ideas and have an outlet. And then over time, I realized, okay, no, you know what, this is the best job in the world. I need to figure out how to only do this for my the rest of my life, and was able to transition to being sort of a full-time blogger at the time, is what they called it.
Yes, I remember those days.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then over time, we got more traffic. We got more sort of people interested in the work that we were doing. I was able to bring on additional freelance writers. And I transitioned away from being the person who's doing all of the writing. So now I am more sort of sitting at the nerve center, looking at all of the interesting places where stories are breaking, be it journals or astronomy meetings, there's press releases, research that's going on, as well as we have a lot of tips and leads that we get from people who are in the industry. And then I package this all up in a way that's good for the writers so that they can, you know, if they have a story they want to work on, there's a bunch of these stories that are prepared and ready to go. And so mostly now my day is spent sort of hunting and gathering interesting little tidbits of space news that I can then pass over to the writers.
Oh, very cool.
It sort of gives me a chance to tell a larger arcing narrative about space and astronomy, but without having to actually sit down and write all the words myself. Instead, it's the stories that I'm curious about, that I'm fascinated by, I put these into this bucket, and the writers are free to write anything they want, anytime, whatever. I have no constraints on this. And yet they keep coming back to the place where I've packaged up all the really nice ones. And so there is a sort of larger theme that unfolds on Universe Today based on my personal curiosity.
Right. Interesting. What types of things are you especially curious about? And can we see those trends on Universe Today?
I love the near future. So not necessarily the far future. I mean, although we do report on Dyson spheres and things like that, I really don't care. But I'm really interested when people come up with really clever ideas on how to solve problems that we're currently facing. So we don't know what's causing the Hubble tension, but here's a really clever way to be able to try and resolve the Hubble tension, or a way to figure out if primordial black holes are an explanation for dark matter, or a way to clean the perchlorates out of the regolith on Mars so that we can grow crops in it. So those are the kinds of stories, but like practical answers to either mysteries that we have or challenges that we face. And I'm just drawn to that all the time. And I love that, just that feeling, that almost like that eureka by proxy, where someone goes, oh, I know a way we could do this. And you're like, oh, that's so clever. I wish I'd thought of that. And so we get to report that.
Yeah, I do often see stories about like emerging tech on University Today. You're so right. Of course you are. It's your website. I first met you when I was doing kind of a round robin style reporting on your show Weekly Space Hangout, which isn't happening anymore, but it does show that you do more than just writing to share space news. So what other ways do you publicize these space stories?
Yeah, obviously, I mean, a lot of the work is done on YouTube, like doing videos and podcasts. And I mean, this is a joke I make, is you and I are sort of battling for the top spot in the astronomy Apple podcast list. And
here, so, we go.
You know, what can we do but reinforce our hegemony here to team up? But yeah, and so I'm always really fascinated by, as new media are released, what is the best way to be able to communicate the kind of ideas that I'm really interested in, the enthusiasm I have for this field, with people, and show up where they are. And so if they want to listen to stuff by audio, then let's make stuff available to my audio. If they would prefer to see pretty graphics and stuff, then let's do some video for them. If they have a attention span that is less than 60 seconds, then I guess that's Instagram Reels. So I think, you know, wherever there is a new way of, you know, some kind of new platform that you need to change the way you're going to produce things creatively, I'm always really interested in, and I'm often the first in there to tinker with it and mess with it, and then decide if it's great or I just don't want to spend any more time with it.
Mm-hmm. And then on those other platforms, you get to be more personally involved because you have this team of writers, but it's you on all of the podcasts and all of the YouTube shows.
Yeah, yeah. And so, for example, like, I do a lot of interviews on my YouTube channel, and that is an offshoot of the work that I'm doing. As I'm looking for stories, things will pique my interest. They'll sort of make me curious, and I've gotten really good at recognizing that moment where you see something, you go, huh, I'd like to know more. And then I go, wait a minute, I can know more. I'll reach out to the person, ask them if I can do an interview with them, and then be able to talk to them. And so often, and then sometimes the writers will then mine the interview that I just did to pull out any scoops, because I'm attempting to figure out what's new, what's interesting, what they're doing. And so it's a fairly, you know, we use every part of the story as best we can.
Cool. Here on Pale Blue Pod, we very rarely go after like breaking news. I feel like I learn about the new stuff from Universe Today. So where do you get your stories? Are you scouring ADS or the archive? Like, what's happening there?
You quickly realize when you work in this sort of the news industry that there's actually very few common sources of content. There's NASA press releases. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, there's the Wires, AP Wire, things like that. And as once you start to sort of be immersed in it, and I'm sure you see this as well, you'll see the same story, but then you'll see 100 variations on that story. And I quickly realized that that's not that interesting to me anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, what can we bring to the conversation that hasn't already been said 1,000 times already? Yes, if Artemis launches, we have to report on that because people think it was super weird that we didn't. Mm-hmm. But I'm way less interested in the stuff that is going to be well covered in other platforms. I'm interested in the stuff that nobody is covering. And so, as you said, archive, ADS, journals that are less reported on. My favorite is actually conferences.
Ooh.
You know, you can go to, say, the American Astronomical Society, the IAU, or there's recently the geology one that just came out.
The AGU?
AGU. And so the people who are going to speak will give a sort of a 2-page summary of what they're going to talk about. And there's no press release. There's nothing else there. I have to look through the list of titles, look through the papers that they're presenting, figure out, is there a story here? And then reach out to the person after they've done their talk and go, can we get some additional details? And then we report on it. And that feels really satisfying to me because we are uncovering, we're doing journalism, right? We are uncovering a story that nobody else knew about.
that is, and in many cases, it's in that sweet spot for me, because they're talking about things that are in the initial stages where people are just kind of mulling ideas over, wondering, you know, would it make sense for us to do a Mars atmospheric sample return instead of trying to do a sample return from the surface? Could we just do a flyby through the atmosphere and then return back to Earth? What could we gain from this? And so there is no press release. And so that's the stuff that really over time, as I've gotten more knowledgeable about the space and astronomy, about the different concepts in it, I've gotten a lot better at being able to spot the things that are stories right at the very, very beginning when they're in those initial stages. And so we do a lot more now. I would say 40 to 50% of our stories are those kinds of sources, our archive, ADS. I don't know, what's the term when a person writes up a paper for their conference? An abstract, I guess?
Yeah.
Abstracts from conferences and scoops. And then half of it is us reporting on the kinds of, you know, new releases from the Hubble Space Telescope, James Webb, press releases, things like that.
But, right, that you have to report on to kind of stay up to date.
Yeah, people will be like, why didn't you tell us that humans had landed on the moon again? And you're like, well, you know, everybody talked about it. So, like, what are we going to add to this?
Yeah, so, but I guess you have to bank on the idea that there are some people who only get their space news from you.
That's
so if you miss something, then they won't get it.
That's exactly it. Like, my hope is to be so good that people will trust that we're going to cover everything that they need, and they're just going to stop relying on other sources. They're just going to shield themselves from the algorithms and just only read Universe Today. No, I probably don't. Maybe that's a bridge too far.
No, I'll tell Pale Blue Pod listeners, go listen to Universe Today for all your breaking space news. You're not going to get it here on Pale Blue Pod. And I trust Universe Today to get it from them. And that skill you were mentioning about being able to go through the list of talks and posters at a conference and pick out the interesting ones that you want to follow up on, I cannot overstate to the listeners how impressive that skill is, because if you've never been to one of these conferences, the list of talks and poster titles, it's so long. So that's a real archaeological dig you have to do there.
So the last AGU took me all day to just make my short list. I'm not kidding. I went through every single talk, looked at the title, looked if it was interesting, put it into a short list, went back to the next one, looked at all the poster presentations, and I think I ended up with a list of 30 stories that we then reported on Universe Today over the course of about a month as we sort of caught up to that backlog. And
that's awesome.
So satisfying. And in many cases, I love it. I mean, we're talking to people who are not prepared to talk to the media. And I try to make sure that they understand that we're not going to abuse this relationship. We're going to, you know, all we want to do is show them off in the best light that we can. There's not a lot of scandal in somebody proposing a Mars sample return mission, you know, atmospheric sample return mission. So it's not like we're going to be digging in unsavory ways. And it's so great to talk to people who are not experienced media people, who aren't sort of haven't been doing the talk show circuit or the podcast circuit or whatever. I love to be able to talk to people who I'm maybe the first podcast interview they've ever done, because then it really feels like you're just sitting around hanging out with some people over beer, chatting about interesting ideas, and nobody is sort of worried about, is this all going to come back to haunt me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're very comforting in that way.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
I think that's one of the big advantages I see for an indie publisher over a more traditional academic publisher, one of the many. You have more freedom and flexibility in what you cover, and you get to give those smaller stories and newer journalists and science communicators a chance. Where, you know, like AppJ, they're not gonna take on a young SciComer the way you took me on when I first joined Weekly Space Hangout.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's my saddest part about the Weekly Space Hangout. Back when we were doing the show, the two co-hosts that were before you, three co-hosts, they all were too busy and they weren't able to continue doing it. And so we had to sort of restructure and decide what we're gonna do next. And I was talking with my wife and she was saying, well, look, what is the part of this whole thing that you like the best? And the thing that I liked was being able to help give people with no media experience, to help them turn from somebody who was interested in being a science communicator to someone who had had practice, because mm-hmm. you know, people remember the format. It was very much that I would be, you would have to present a story, and then I would be interviewing you about the story that you were presenting. I was very careful to know what your strengths were and what your weaknesses were, and make sure that I was both navigating that as well as helping you be able to present the story. So it was a very, mm-hmm. I think, a very flexible and very, you know, not difficult environment, but it gave practice.
Yeah.
And then after a while, you just get better and better and better. You realize the things you hadn't prepared that you should have prepared, because it was obvious that I was going to ask that question.
Right.
And then over time, people just got better and better. And I think there aren't a lot of outlets. You have to go from, I have no experience in science communication, to I'm expected to be really, really good. And if I don't have that way to be in between there, then there's no place to progress. And that's mm-hmm. the thing that I was so proud of that we were doing, was just giving as many people, anyone who wanted to put up their hand and say, this is a job I want to do, we were able to give them this outlet. And I still try to figure out ways to be able to do that same thing today, because that's, I think that's the value that I can bring to the science mm-hmm. communication community.
Yeah, it was so valuable. And you were really good, like you said, at knowing our strengths, but also pushing us. Like, I remember there were some times when I would be reporting on like black holes or something that's not in my personal wheelhouse, and you would ask just like one question a bit further than what I was comfortable knowing without doing research. It was great. You're a really good teacher and like mentor in that way.
Yeah. And so I'm always sort of thinking like, how can we bring that back? How can I sort of resurface that in what I'm doing today? Because it's the thing that I miss the most, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you see any other salient advantages or differences between indie and academic publishing. Corinne and I just finished talking about that, and it's, even just participating in both, it feels very different.
So I don't have any real personal experience about academic publishing. I mean,
Good for you.
Yeah. So I barely understand it. I see it from afar. And of course, you know, Dr. Pamela Gay is my co-host on Astronomy Cast, and mm-hmm. and I've seen her go through all of the trials and tribulations of trying to get her work published or get funding and all that kind of stuff. So I'm familiar with it, but at the same time, I am so completely insulated from it. I mean, their university is completely self-funded. We're essentially funded by the patrons, so, and a little bit of advertising. And so there really are there's nobody who has any kind of, like, I don't have to ask anybody for permission to do anything ever. I just I think of an idea and then we just do it. Right.
Yeah. And then there are paywalls.
There's no paywalls. Everything is available free. In fact, we do the minimum of advertising. There's no advertising in our podcast. There's no advertising on my newsletter. There's no advertising on Patreon, and we make the Patreon free. So there's a place you can get all of our content for free. And a lot of people are always super concerned about the things that they want to publish, because they're concerned about, is it going to be difficult for me to get funding from NASA later on or whatever? Mm. And I don't care. Just bother me. But yeah.
And you get to pay the writers, which is different from academic publishing.
Yes.
We do not get paid to publish in AppJ or MNRAS. The writer often has to pay for the privilege of being published, but that's not the case for you.
Every time someone tries to explain how the publishing system works to me, I just wait a minute, what? You don't get paid as a peer reviewer? What? And yet you're expected to do a good job? I definitely know more about it now than I once did. And a lot of people, like when I'll report on something in archive, and people will say, oh, you can't report on that because it hasn't been peer reviewed yet. Mm-hmm. And I just say like, oh, peer reviewed. Like, you mean when the journal sends your thing to a couple of people who are completely overworked, they don't get any compensation, they're really just, you know, and how good their peer review is just depends entirely on how much time they have and how committed they are to the peer review of science. Like, it can be an important thing or a worthless thing. And so, no, we just say it's not a peer-reviewed article, and you can decide what that means to you. So, I don't care anymore.
Is there any sort of fact-checking process, or because you're getting things from the source, you're like, we're reporting on what the source says?
That's exactly it, yeah. So we report on, say, a paper, and we will reach out to the researcher and get their quotes. And if it's a really tricky kind of story, we'll ask them to do a a look through what we've done to make sure that what we're covering is accurate to the way they're trying to explain it. You know, if there's something that has controversy, then we will go to someone who's unaffiliated and get some additional quotes from them as a way to, as a counter. You know, mm-hmm. somebody says that wide binaries are evidence of dark matter, you know, with Mond and so on, then we'll have somebody who maybe is critical of that and get a counterpoint. But, you know, it depends on the story and the instincts of the writer. You know, mm-hmm. people have a very wide latitude on Universe Today for, you know, I trust the team to be good journalists and mm-hmm. don't put a lot of sort of systems in place on that.
Are there things that you would not publish? Like, does everything have to run through you ultimately?
Okay. So, I mean, are there things that we would not publish? Yes. But like, it hasn't come up because okay. there aren't many things that we would not publish, but the gist is, and no, things don't go through me. So mm-hmm. all the writers are essentially free to write whatever they want. And when they've claimed a story, they publish the story. And then I will sometimes read about it afterwards as I'm sort of summarizing their work. Yeah.
Well, you do not have my control issues.
No, I don't. And I think it's really important because it slows the whole thing down. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're covering breaking news. And so I have to just trust that Nancy Atkinson, for example, who's been doing this job for almost as long as Universe Today has been around. She knows her stuff and she's going to get it right. And then I don't have to worry about it. And also Nancy will come up, find a story and just report on it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they'll let me know, but other times I'll be reading Universe Today and go, oh, that's a cool story.
Oh, I can learn that.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I should interview that person for my podcast. And so it's really about the overall, like, we're science oriented. We are facts based. We are reality believing on Universe Today. Mm-hmm. And so there are certain kinds of concepts, certain, you know, theoretical concepts in space flight, in alien visitation, in wormholes, you know, in stuff that's out at the fringes of science or of space that the entire team understands our kind of collective opinion about that kind of stuff mm-hmm. and tends not to stray into those areas. Or, nice. You know, there are people who are more specialized in that kind of stuff, like Brian Koberline is a PhD astrophysicist, and he's the one who will often take on stuff that are a lot more tricky in a more theoretical physics sense. And so mm-hmm. there's certain people who are better than other people at certain things that, you know, I trust them to grab those stories and report on them because I know they're going to give a nice balanced opinion or balanced coverage. Like I haven't sat down and said like, this is our belief system, culture. Yeah. Right?
Like our ethos or something.
Our ethos, yeah. But it has definitely kind of evolved. It has emerged on its own over time. And I wonder if, you know, all of the broadcasting work that I do, all of the questions that I answer help set the tone. Because the writers can all hear me. Yeah, the way I answer questions, the way I think about things. Then hopefully that has a certain impact on the way they consider the news as well.
Mm-hmm. And part of being a good leader is putting together a good team with diverse skill sets and complementary knowledge bases.
Yeah. As a leader, your job is to find people who are better than you at the job. but the thing that you have to then do is let them be better than you.
Yeah.
And so that's it. It comes, and if they aren't better than you, then you can absolutely step in and go, oh, you know, you made this mistake here, and then you want to see them adapt and never make that mistake again. But apart from that, yeah, it's a massive trust-based organization. I'm going to blow your mind, actually. So we don't have any meetings in the company.
You don't have meetings?
Don't have any meetings. Yeah, yeah.
You did blow my mind.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Never, never. We have never met. I have never sat down and had like a pitch meeting or anything with the team. Like either they pick a story that has already been pre-approved because I found a story and I found it's really interesting. I put it in a form that they can grab and work with, or they have a scoop or they have a story they want to cover that's of their own and they just do it. And it has,
nice.
You almost have to be the right kind of personality to work for Universe Today. You have to be okay with that. Like,
yeah,
because it will feel kind of lonely because you're not going to have Fraser in your jam all the time, wondering what you're doing. Well, how's it going? How's that story? I've got mm-hmm. some more changes I need you to make. Yeah, I need you to wait until I give you none of that. I feel like it might even be to the extreme, to the point that they are, you know, feel a little sad. So some people just wash out because they're looking for a certain amount of handholding and a certain amount of community.
Right.
And we don't provide that. And so for a certain kind of person I know who kind of needs more camaraderie, they're not going to find that at Universe today.
So good to know that about yourself and your organization.
Yeah, for sure. I think, like, I know that being in meetings just makes me want to chew my leg off. And so I would never inflict that on my team. I would do anything to not inflict that on my team, even if that means, you know, making them feel lonely and lacking community.
Yeah, it works for people. I love it. I had to tell my grad school advisor, I was like, look, I want very few meetings and I'll let you know when I'm ready for one.
Yeah.
And he respected that. It was great.
That was great.
I'm sure you've covered hundreds, thousands of stories by now. Do you have any that really stand out to you as the most memorable stories that you've covered, or like the story of covering a story? Have you had to chase someone down or do anything crazy?
Oh, so we're at 30,000 stories on Universe Today right now.
Wow.
Yeah. Over 25
Congratulations.
Years. It all just blurs, right? So I don't have like specific memorable stories. I mean, there's some amazing stories where we got really interesting. I don't know if you remember when New Horizons was threatened with being canceled about a year ago, 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we got some scoops from people close to the source. And I was really honored that they came to us with this. And Carolyn Collins Peterson actually was the one who grabbed that story and started to run with it. And it turned into a whole series with a lot of investigation. And she was able to actually get admissions out of NASA that things were more serious than people were expecting. And so that felt really good.
Yeah.
That we were able to kind of, you know, we got the scoop and we handled it very well. And maybe we helped get some resolution for things to come together. But for me, it feels more like obsessions. So I'll be running three or four obsessions simultaneously that I'm then pattern matching against various stories that are coming up to see if they're going to fulfill some portion of that obsession. Like just right now, my obsessions are, you know, is there any way to use large language models for science, for astronomy? Can we, you know, is there some way that we can use this generative content for space astronomy to improve images, to pattern match, things like that?
Yeah.
I'm really interested in situ resource utilization. Like if we go to the moon, we go to Mars, can we live off the land? What are the different technologies that are going to be needed? Mm-hmm. I have this just gnawing horror that people don't understand how awful it's going to be to live on Mars, and that we're not prepared, that we don't have the technology. And every time I hear somebody suggest a way that they can sinter regolith to produce bricks, I feel like a little bit of relief that at least people are starting to realize, oh, like how are toilets going to work?
Mm-hmm.
And it probably feeds into a larger, like a fascination with 3D printing, with von Neumann probes, like how do we explore the universe, self-replicating robot probes that go off into the universe, and can we gather and harvest the resources that we want from. I'm also quite obsessed with, on the flip side, about how we consider the solar system as a natural, as a wilderness. You know, we're here beside my river, my favorite river, and this is a park, and it wouldn't exist unless people had set this aside and said, this is a place that is special, that we want to make sure that as many people can enjoy it forever.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only one Olympus Mons. There's only one Valles Marineris. There's only one Iapetus, Enceladus. There are these places across the solar system that are very special.
Mm-hmm.
And I worry that we will just pave them as we move forward. And I think about what makes the solar system special. And there's lots of little rocks and boulders and blobs of ice that we can grind up to make our von Neumann probes. But I love future generations to be able to walk in Valles Marineris and appreciate it like you're walking in the Grand Canyon. I am obsessed with primordial black holes as an explanation for dark matter and disproving it, you know, and like what is the source of the supermassive black holes at less than a billion years after the Big Bang, you know, it really is starting to feel like direct collapse is the explanation for these biggest black holes.
Yeah, but then I want to see what collapsed to make it.
What collapsed? What were the process? Yeah. How do you get gas funneled into a tight space to the mm-hmm. point that you can get a black hole that has hundreds of millions of times the mass of the sun? What? Yeah. Yeah. So I think for me, I get these obsessions, and then I have to make them run their course. I have to interview a bunch of people until I'm like, okay, I feel like I've gathered all the information that I have for now. I've satisfied that curiosity, but then something else has come up that I look at. So
mm-hmm. it's nice that you've picked a job that will always let you learn.
Well, so I think it's really important that as a creator, you focus on doing the stuff that you're curious and interested in. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of the stuff that we do that is for the people who are reading the site and so on. But there's a lot of stuff that I do is purely to satisfy my own personal curiosity. And that replenishes my stamina. Mm-hmm. Because I think that for a lot of people, when you realize that something is doing well, is successful, you figured out a niche for yourself, then the algorithms latch on and go, now do more of this. Now do this 1,000 times. You know, and I always think about like people who are stuck making Minecraft videos on mm-hmm. Twitch for 20 years because the algorithm won't let them stop. And yeah. and I think that we as creators need to have that balance between the stuff that is going to entertain the fan base who we've created, but also that we're able to express our own creativity and curiosity in ways that you're not going to lose your entire business if you do this. And that's what keeps me as excited today, more excited today, 25 years into doing this job mm-hmm. than when I started. And I read about, and I'm sure you've seen tons of these creators getting burned out.
Yep.
And I think it's because they're not following their own curiosity.
Mm-hmm. That's a great piece of advice.
Yeah, yeah. It's something that I've realized that I've been doing unintentionally, like I do, because I just can't help myself. Mm-hmm. But I realize that is my almost vaccination. It's almost the way that I prevent the burnout is that I'm so looking forward to interviewing somebody about mm-hmm. a piece of really obscure research that's going to answer a bunch of my questions that and then I'm like, oh yeah, and I've got to do that news roundup. Okay, right.
Got to instead of got get to.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so real, letting your life be driven by curiosity. I myself try to let my life be driven by play and purpose. Like, what will be the most fun and what do I think will help me make a difference in the world?
Both seem really valid. Like, I don't think about that at all, about the play and the purpose.
But you get there, still.
I get there, yeah, for sure. They're nice side effects, right? But for me, it's curiosity. Like, mm-hmm. all it is that I've honed that instinct to go, I'd like to know more about that, into this entire downstream set of activities that go on.
Downstream. How perfect. What a perfect segue. This has been a lovely time by this river of yours. Do you have any last thoughts on independent publishing, what it means to you and what it could mean to other people?
I think we're going through a lot of people are really concerned about the media industry right now. And I think that mostly I think you need to be concerned about the dinosaurs. At the same time, there is just an enormous amount of really great reporting that's happening from small groups, from individuals that are blogging, that are with a Patreon, that are reaching a community, and they're able to craft a living for themselves. And you could do this job from anywhere on earth. And so you can match your standard of living to the expenses of the place where you live. And then you can just, you devote yourself to the information needs of a very specific audience. And by doing so, you can absolutely make a career and you don't need permission. You don't need somebody to choose you. Mm-hmm. You choose yourself.
Yeah, you can be so much more nimble when you don't have to like answer to any big bureaucratic beast.
Yeah, you don't get the safety, but we need the safety was a sham. The safety's gone. So you don't get the safety, but what you do get is, back to that purpose, you're serving the needs of a community mm-hmm. the best that you can.
Oh, that was great. That was great. Thank you so much, Fraser. I feel like if people are interested in space, they've probably heard of Universe Today. But just in case they haven't before this episode, can you tell the listeners where they can find you and your work online?
Well, obviously the website Universe Today, but the best thing to do is just sign up for my weekly email newsletter. So I write this like magazine every week of all of the interesting stories, both on Universe Today, but then I also put links to all my competitors so you can check and see what they're doing. But all the stories that we missed, so we can give them props. So yeah, that's just at universetoday.com/newsletter. And I write every word. There's no ads. It's totally free.
Yay! I enjoy learning from Fraser Cain and all of the writers that he has gotten to be involved with Universe Today. So listeners, I think you will also enjoy learning from them. All right, I'm going to head out from this park. I got to go tell Corinne what I learned about your work. Fraser, thank you so much for being with me today and chatting about your work.
Thanks for having me.
And now I'm back with Corinne.
Hi.
Hi. Corinne, I wish you could have been there. You really would have loved that that river. And that mossy bench actually was really comfy, like built into the tree.
It sounds so lovely. It sounds immediately soothing.
Yes. Yes, it was. It was also soothing to hear about Fraser's experience in independent publishing and how he's able to kind of give a voice to the smaller stories and the early career journalists. That was nice.
I love that.
So after all of this talk about publishing, Corinne, how do you feel about it? And is there anything else you want to know?
Well, I think we touched on like why it might be useful to publish in these like higher name papers. You get some more credibility. You might be more likely to be up for specific jobs. But I totally understand the appeal of like moving to a more like equitable place to share info and publish findings.
Agreed. We kind of need to, especially as the whole mis and disinformation crisis spreads.
Yeah.
You know, like that's already a problem. Generative AI is making it an even more extreme problem. And it shouldn't be cheaper and easier for me to find wrong information than right information.
Yeah. I do want all of this to come with like a media training plan for us to like be able to decipher that stuff faster. Mm-hmm. And like the whole point of it is so that it's not deciphered or caught. But yeah, I want to get rid of it.
Get rid of it. Just
get out of here.
Tear it all down. Rebuild something better from the ground up.
Love. The dream.
The dream. All right. Well, listeners, even if you don't dream, literally dream at night about building better academic publishing systems, that's fine. You're still space and we still love you.
Bye.
Bye.
Pale Blue Pod was created by Moya McTeer and Corinne Caputo with help from the Multitude Productions team. Our theme music is by Evan Johnston and our cover art is by Shay McMullen. Our audio editing is handled by the incomparable Misha Stanton.
Stay in touch with us and the universe by following at Pale Blue Pod on Twitter and Instagram, or check out our website, palebluepod.com. We're a member of Multitude, an independent podcast collective and production studio. If you like Pale Blue Pod, you will love the other shows that live on our website at multitude.productions.
If you want to support Pale Blue Pod financially, join our community over at patreon.com/palebluepod. For just about $1 per episode, you get a shout out on one of our shows and access to director's commentary for each episode. The very best way, though, to help Pale Blue Pod grow is to share it with your friends. So send this episode, this link, to one person who you think will like it, and we will appreciate you for forever.
Thanks for listening to Pale Blue Pod. You'll hear us again next week.
Bye.